Emily Martin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what data are you seeing right now that you find most concerning?
So we're definitely seeing sharp rises. I think it's been, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how we're seeing a lot of increases in cases in young people, in younger adults, and in in children. However, I'm particularly concerned to see reports of hospitalizations going up. I think, you know, as we started to see rises in cases in younger people, we were sort of hoping that hospitalizations would stay low. But unfortunately, you know, we have this group of individuals in the state that are not, there's not a ton of vaccination yet because they're lower down in the priority. So say, you know, the 50-year-old age range, younger, you know, 60 to 65-year-olds. So not a lot of vaccination in those groups, but still really high risk of hospitalization. And so we're starting to see those numbers move now. And that's really what's worrying me the most, I think.
Do we yet have information or data around the severity of the cases that are coming in with those hospitalizations?
So, you know, anytime somebody is hospitalized, that's sort of our biggest marker of severity. What we look for, you know, because this is a really slow disease to develop, it's still going to take us a little while to see whether we're going to start to see death numbers start to increase. And, you know, that should be happening over the next couple of weeks if it's going to follow from the hospitalization numbers. And I think we're still waiting to find out about that.
When we look at the, you know, the charts and the graphs of the numbers as they've been over the past year, it certainly looks like we are on a steep incline as we've seen with the two previous major surges in the state. Would you say that we are heading into a third wave or a surge right now?
There's definitely markers in the data that reflect the previous surges. And so I think it is something to be concerned about that we could be heading in that direction. You know, I know that it's great that we've got vaccine more widely available, and it's really coming, you know, the numbers are increasing in terms of how much vaccine is coming into the state, but the percentage of the state that's vaccinated is still low enough that we don't have enough vaccine to stop a surge if it were to occur. And so we're, you know, we're definitely concerned that if this rise takes off, that it could be definitely another wave.
So as we've been calling this sort of a race against time, right, between COVID and vaccinations, does that mean that COVID is basically winning that race between the two?
I mean, I do really like this analogy of the race between the vaccine and the virus. And one of the real tricky things about this is the introduction of the variant. It's like you're running a race with somebody and then all of a sudden that the other person starts running 50% faster, right? And so the goal is that we want to win the race. We want to get the virus low in the community as much as possible before that virus becomes replaced by this faster spreading variant virus. So we either need to bring transmission down or we need to bring vaccine up.
Well, when we look at Michigan in comparison to other states, Michigan is doing particularly poorly right now, even when juxtaposed with states that maybe have fewer restrictions in place. What is the explanation behind that? Would it be this new, I mean, we couldn't call it the new variant, but it's sort of just now the new, the variant.
Yeah.
is that what it's attributable to?
It's probably a combination of a number of factors. And, you know, I think actually the numbers in Michigan are really interesting because we were lower than a lot of our nearby states for a while. We had less of an impact over the holiday season than a lot of states did. And then we've sort of caught up and surpassed them pretty quickly. And so to some degree, this is a little bit of a catch up from us starting out from a lower place. But now we're starting to creep up above where those other states are. Even given that, and it's probably a combination of more of this B.1.1.7 strain that moves 50% faster. So we definitely know that it's here in Michigan. We definitely know it's increasing. It's probably not the main strain that's around. We have a lot of regular old strain of COVID too. Other reasons that this could be increasing, though, we're also seeing in the data a ton of mobility. So we're seeing people moving around. In some sectors, they're moving around almost as much as they were even pre-pandemic. So we're seeing a lot of activity And in gatherings and kind of the reintroductions of activities that people have stayed away from. And so that's creating the ability for the virus to move from group to group, you know, a lot faster than it has been in the last few months.
You know, I like to think of Michigan as a bit of a Cassandra, not only when it comes to the pandemic, but sort of like lots of various concerning elements, whether it's the economy or any sort of social pressures that are going on, that Michigan sort of likes to lead the way in what's to come for the rest of the country. And it sounds like maybe that could be the case here as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we in Michigan are really seeing a lot of signs of that COVID fatigue that we've been hearing starting to introduce. And I think once we got to this 1 year mark for the pandemic, there's really this feeling of, you know, okay, you know, a lot of families missed one Easter together. They don't want to miss two Easters together. And so there becomes this tension between this real desire to go back into these spaces and to start doing these activities again. The weather's beautiful. And so people are really wanting to get out there, but with the vaccine hasn't caught up to that same level of activity yet. So we have so much optimism and we're looking forward to this future when we're going to be able to do all this stuff again. And we want it to be now, but it is still a little bit too early.
Yeah, Michiganders definitely like to revel in mild March weather. And this is probably exactly. Not the best year for that to be happening. Yeah, the governor and her administration do not appear at this point to be very interested in dialing back liberties that we feel like we're gaining back or to prevent another wave. Do you think that there's less concern right now because a higher proportion of high-risk people have been vaccinated?
You know, I do think that definitely it changes the ingredients for decision makers, right? Because we have a lot more vaccine in the groups that are most likely to have very severe outcomes. But, you know, COVID can be very serious for younger ages too. I'm especially worried about this, like 50 to 65 year old age that doesn't have a ton of vaccination yet, but can have very severe outcomes. Yeah, it's complex. I do have to say that, you know, in public health, we sort of see also that economic stress can also be a public health crisis. And so I don't envy them in having to balance these two forces against each other.
Right.
And, you know, because we do have to make sure people are able to earn a living and take care of their families while, you know, trying to keep the health risk as low as possible. And I do think it's definitely a dance between those two sides.
We've been talking on the show lately about the push and pull between regulations versus personal responsibility. And this idea that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And we've heard it even, you know, from some top health officials, that idea. So then why, if the onus then becomes on the individual to restrain from doing it, why not just have the restriction in place then that says not only shouldn't you, but you can't?
Right. Well, and actually, I think that's especially true for the things that we have kept in place, like the masks. That's really an individual level mitigation measure that an individual has to wear a mask that has little to no economic impact, right? And so I think stuff like that definitely makes a lot of sense. You know, the tricky thing is when we see a lot of, right now we're seeing a lot of cases that have to do with gatherings. And that's not something that really interfaces with an economic sector necessarily, because it's stuff that people are doing in their homes or, you know, in businesses that are open, but not necessarily for the purpose of serving big gatherings. And so it really becomes that really difficult thing to regulate. You know, that's when you start to see these policies that get into things like, okay, well, you can have three households gathering at a time with no more than X number of people, right? It gets very complex to try to make that into a rule, which is really sort of this common sense thing. The common sense piece is the more new people that you're have close contact exposure with in a given week time frame, that's how much bigger your contact tracing network gets if you end up finding out that you've been infected. And it's really hard to take a common sense thing like that and turn it into a policy. And I sort of see that struggle nationwide is how do you actually make that a regulation when it's more just like, please keep it down to smaller groups.
Well, when we're talking about small groups and something that is within the strictures of regulation. Should schools be open now that we're seeing also cases going up because of gatherings in schools and not outside of the school?
You know, really, I think that the data is pretty strong that transmission in the classroom can be pretty limited so long as community rates are low. And so in order to keep schools open, I kind of like to flip it on its head and think about what do we need to do to keep schools open, right? If schools are our priority, well, we need to keep rates low around the school. And that doesn't, you know, that means kind of the whole community around the school, but it also means what I call school adjacent activities, right? Not necessarily exposures that happen in the school, but maybe sports or extracurriculars or gatherings that happen that are sort of driven by the relationships that are built in school. And it's by kind of building more mitigation and protections into those spaces around the school that sort of allows the school to remain open and keep running. Because I think, I mean, everybody's sort of in agreement now that school's really important and we need to try to protect it. But it means that we might have to make balancing decisions in other areas, you know, that are going to influence how much virus pressure is around the school.
I want to pivot now and talk a little bit about the role of skepticism in this, in the whole saga. Right now, we're at this place where demand is exceeding supply of vaccine. But do you expect that at some point we're going to see a tipping point where we need more folks to get vaccinated, but the skeptics or those who are at least resistant to getting vaccinated won't be interested in receiving the vaccination that is available to them?
Yeah, I think actually that tipping point is going to happen. It's not, we're not too far away from it. I think once we have it so that it's not a scarce resource, I think that that tipping point is going to become really, really important that we start planning for it. Because, right, just, you know, there's two factors at play. Just because the vaccine is available doesn't mean that somebody is going to want to get it. But it also means that somebody may not go through the trouble to get it. And this is sort of setting aside access issues. Some communities have much better access than others. We need to make sure that's addressed. But you may have somebody that's perfectly willing to get it, but they're going to want it brought to their workplace. Or, you know, they're going to want to be down the street. They're not going to want to drive 20 miles to, they're not going to set an appointment and kind of go through any trouble. This is sort of what we've learned with the flu vaccine, is that a lot more people get it when it becomes convenient and offered, you know, right there. You're walking by some place that's offering it. They've got one ready for you right now. And then people will get it. But people won't necessarily go out of their way to get it. And so that's what I think we have to plan around as we get to this place where it's like really, really available.
And when you say that you think we're not too far away from that, do you anticipate that we will reach that tipping point then before we reach herd immunity?
I think we will. What I imagine to be is that supply stops being the constraint as we get out of the spring into the summer. And then the summer is going to be this battle of the last couple of miles of trying to get from, you know, 50, 75% vaccination to 80 to 90%. And that's where, you know, speaking to communities that are hesitant becomes important. And that's where making sure that like access and convenience are a priority.
We're hearing stories about people driving hours, sometimes spanning the entire state in order to get vaccinated right now. We need to make sure that vaccines get into all parts of the state. But, you know, it seems like it's a bit counterintuitive, right? The lengths that some people are willing to go or having to go to get vaccinated when maybe the vaccine isn't as desired in a community.
Yeah.
How do you balance those two things, I guess, would be my question.
Yeah, it is a bit of a paradox. The way I like to think about it is that, you know, there are some people in our state that are have the means and the ability and the agency to move around and kind of seek out and find vaccines in all corners. There are some people that don't. To the best that we can target vaccine availability, right, sort of geographically located around communities where people don't have that agency, that ability to take a day off of work and drive across the state to get the vaccine, we should be doing that, right? But eventually, you know, I'm hoping that this becomes more of a larger spider web of networks so that as it becomes more and more available, you'll see availability in more and more locations. And you'll see locations be consistently stocked to the point where it then becomes convenient for everybody.
Then let's talk about the idea of flattening the curve. It's something that the state pushed a lot with the past two surges that we saw. Is it possible to flatten that curve again, or are we just are these factors that are sort of converging at the same time, whether it's weather and fatigue and the hope of vaccine right around the corner? Is it going to make it much more difficult to flatten the curve in short order and instead something that maybe we'll have to view on a long-term spectrum?
I think we can still flatten the curve, but it's going to take individual decision-making, and that's where it gets tricky because we still have fairly straightforward tools that we know work, right? We know that masks work. We know that being outdoors is safer than being indoors, and we know that smaller groups are better than larger groups. So these are the exact same tools that we had a year ago. And I think the trick is going to be figuring out how to do that kind of connection that people are craving, but do it in ways that are safe enough so that we can ride out the next couple of months until the vaccine gets fully deployed.
When we're talking about this desire to return to normal, what's it going to take to achieve something that feels more akin to normal interactions with friends, family, and colleagues? And when do you see that normalcy or that normality being achieved?
You know, I'm pretty optimistic that if the patterns that we're seeing with vaccination continue, that as we get into the fall, we have a chance of being in a scenario where, you know, most of the time things are feeling like they're returning to normal with isolated pockets of outbreaks that have to be contained and monitored and dealt with when they happen. And so we get into this more of an adaptive situation where sometimes things are really high and we might have to walk back a little bit, put our masks back on, but then sometimes things are really low and we're kind of able to continue on to something that feels very close. There are some elements of normal that I don't think are coming back. And one of those is how we view respiratory illness. I think we're going to get away from this pattern that we've always had where it's like, oh, I had a cold and I had a fever and I'm feeling really crappy, but I powered through it. I went to work anyways. And I think we should start preparing ourselves now that we're supporting people in the next like cold and flu season that's going to come, you know, a little under a year from now, because I don't think that's going to be happening again.
When, you know, we've seen mask wearing become fairly commonplace during cold and flu season in some East Asian countries that have experienced outbreaks of viruses in the past. And I think from an American standpoint, it was like, oh, that's so strange wanting to do that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I'm going to keep my masks on handy, you know, on hand well into the future, if not forever, because I don't see myself weathering a cold and flu season anymore without a mask out in public.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been thinking the same thing, that I can imagine traveling with a mask, you know, going through airports and airplanes. I always get sick after air travel. And so I can imagine masking up for air travel in the future. And then just generally in crowded spaces in cold and flu seasons, I think I can see me, my family members doing the same thing, that we do selective masking in situations going forward. And, you know, I think this is the first year I can remember since I started working with children that I've ever had a year without being sick. Mm-hmm. And
same.
So,
yes, right.
You know, I'm sold in terms of masking.
Totally. I mean, the hygiene that we are practicing right now hopefully will be a new normal, right?
Right, right.
Emily Martin is a doctor, an associate professor, an epidemiologist with the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.